U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome. I'm Bill McGurn with the Wall Street Journal. This is Potomac Watch. We're joined today by my colleagues, Wall Street Journal columnist Kim Strassel and editorial writer Jason Willick. Kim, I'd like to start with you. Joe Biden has nominated David Weil to run the Wage and Hour Division of the Labor Department. Now, that sounds like a pretty boring and innocuous title, right? So why is so much of the business community alarmed? And do you think this in any way puts his confirmation in jeopardy? I think there's a vote next week.
Yeah, so they're alarmed because they know what this guy is about, right? As I wrote my column today, sometimes you fear the unknown. But in this case, this is a lot of alarm over the familiar, because this guy had the exact same job at a Wage and Hour Division at the Department of Labor from 2014 to early 2017. He was an Obama nominee. And what he did when he was there was really quite extraordinary. He could see that he was the sort of person willing to bend the law or overstep the law in order to impose by regulatory fiat things that Congress had not passed. So he put in place, for instance, an overtime rule. It was incredibly sweeping. It would have raised, almost doubled, the salary level under which you would be counted as someone who deserved overtime. It would have added almost 4 million people to those eligible for overtime, employers having to pay them more. That was ultimately struck down by a federal court in Texas in 2017, a judge calling it drastic and saying that it ignored Congress's clear writing on how overtime was meant to be structured. He was incredibly hostile to people who worked in the franchise area or contractors, gig workers, anyone who claims to be independent and therefore not organizable by the unions. He came up with a new definition of what counted as an independent contractor that basically got rid of most contractors. So they know what's coming if this guy comes back. They're even more alarmed because now the Biden administration is pushing its PRO Act. And so they've really mobilized against them and against this nomination. And they're trying to convince a handful of Senate Democrats who haven't signed on to the PRO Act to oppose this nomination.
Yeah, Jason, a lot of people have been rallying. I think we haven't seen this kind of business mobilization before. In Kim's column, she mentioned 14 industry groups, International Franchise Association, National Association of Home Builders, Independent Electric Contractors, National Restaurant Association, U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Hispanic Leadership Fund. This is quite a quite an array of groups that think he would be harmful for business. Is his nomination, is it another example of the Biden administration putting more pieces into place for a large administrative state that could do with regulation what really ought to be done, if it ought to be done at all, by Congress?
I thought Kim's point about the extent of the business mobilization is very interesting, because if you asked an American who just lived through 2020 and 2021, you said, you know, businesses are mobilizing, you would think it was a social cause, you know, a voting bill, you know, an abortion bill, some sort of culture war issue, because that's how we've gotten used to business engaging in politics over the last couple of years, is basically engaging in the culture war. So this is a little bit reassuring in the sense that it feels like things are going a little bit back to normal, where business is lobbying the government and making its you know, talking to senators about things that actually concern business and not some unrelated issue. And I think you know, the question is going to be, you know, as Republicans sort of navigate their relationship with business, are they going to, you know, be an ally? You know, because some Republicans don't want to be an ally of business if business is going to be associated with woke cultural causes. But now we have, you know, the causes more aligned in a more traditional way once again. So I think it's definitely an interesting development and suggests, you know, maybe that this realignment of businesses politics isn't going to go necessarily as far as we might think if, you know, businesses' interests are threatened and they're still going to go back to their first principles.
Kim, you mentioned also that in some ways his nomination is seen as the Trojan horse for the PRO Act, which business also has some concerns about. Can you explain what the PRO Act is, how this nomination affects it, and what, again, what businesses are afraid of from the PRO Act? Would this be another, again, barnacle on the administrative state that once it's passed would be very hard to modify or withdraw?
Yeah. So the PRO Act is short for Protecting the Right to Organize Act. The House first passed it last February, Nancy Pelosi's House. And it is the most sweeping change to labor practices in the United States, probably since 1947, when the Taft-Hartley Act was imposed. It would get rid of most of that, severely stacking the deck in favor of unions and organized labor over individual workers, or indeed over the owners of companies. So just a few of its provisions to give you an idea of how radical this bill is. I think the highlight is it would nullify every state right to work law we have. Those are laws that protect individuals from having to join a union or pay dues. There are 27 states right now that have right to work laws. This would get rid of them essentially overnight. It's an enormous attack, again, as we were mentioning, on independent contractors. It would essentially adopt California's ABC test to narrow the definition of who counts as an independent contractor and whether they are free from union coercion. It would basically impose a nationwide ABC test. It has a number of provisions that make it far easier for unions to bully people into joining. It would require employers to share their workers' personal information, including their emails and their cell numbers. It would give them new options to use card check to get people organized. That's a provision in which, instead of having a secret vote to vote for a union, you basically bully people into putting their name on a card. And when they get the right number, then a union is formed. And there are a lot of other provisions like this. And the problem for the Biden administration is that this is not likely to pass the Senate because it needs 60 votes. They don't have it. It also, because it's deals a great deal with policy, would be very hard to sneak into, for instance, the budget reconciliation process they're about to do, because that's supposed to be about spending and taxes. It's not supposed to be about policy. So what people really fear is that if all that goes haywire and they don't get it across the finish line, that guys like David Weil and the NLRB and all of these pro-labor outfits under Biden are instead going to do it by regulatory fiat and go around Congress,
which would be a lot worse, right, Kim? I mean, it at least in legislation, you have an open debate, up or down vote, and you can modify it later. When it's done by regulators, you know, most people don't even know about it except the people that are affected, and there's very little relief from it. You know, from the administrative state is probably the least accountable aspect of American government today.
Right. And it's also, by the way, just notably, arguably illegal. Right. Remember, we have this thing called the separation of powers, and Congress is supposed to write our statutes and lay out how this is supposed to work. And then the regulators are supposed to take that and come up with rules that fit with Congress's meaning. You know, in this case, you outright have Democrats saying, we recognize that all of these things need to be passed by law, but if Congress won't do it, we'll just have the regulators make it up instead. It's a recipe, in addition for what you said, to a very problematic situation for businesses, crushing costs and uncertainty. But it's a recipe for a lot of litigation that could tie a lot of this up in courts for years.
And Jason, just stepping back from the particular issues in this bill, it obviously would carry with it a lot of costs. Why is the Biden administration insisting as we're coming off COVID-19 and trying to get the economy up and running, does the Biden administration really believe, as it says, that these kind of things are key to growing the economy? I mean, if you listen to the language, it's going to, you know, we're going to have high paying green union jobs and so forth. But, the reality seems a little more prosaic. But do they really believe that? And why would you do that, you know, when we're just coming out of the problem, and when, you know, employers are desperate for employees and so forth, that we really need to get the economy humming again?
Yeah, I think part of the theory of some of the economic agenda may be that we're going to grow at such a fast rate as we bounce out of the pandemic that people won't notice the sort of burdens that are attached to the economy, new burdens on taxes and regulations. Of course, you know, it will slow down the recovery, and those will become felt in a bigger way down the line. I would also just say, in terms of, you know, the biggest thing to me about the PRO Act is states have right to work laws. They've been legislating, 27 states have right to work laws, which don't allow you to be compelled to join a union. And for the federal government to overturn that, in one fell swoop, overturn 27 considered state laws, seems to me especially, you know, incongruent with the idea of healing America, which, you know, should theoretically make room for different solutions to different sort of labor arrangements, rather than telling 27 state legislatures that too bad the Washington's changing the rules for everybody.
Okay, hang tight. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal editorial page.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back to Potomac Watch. We've been discussing David Whale's nomination to the Labor Department, but I want to switch gears for a second. All across the U.S. today, there are these huge fights at very elite public schools, from Boston to Virginia to San Francisco and New York, and they're over admissions. Many of these very, very competitive schools have had admissions based on a single, very rigorous, but race-blind admissions test. And now, with the rise of the demands for equity, there's a demand to drop those tests for something more subjective. A lot of the proponents would say more holistic. And the result of this, in almost all these cities where it's been tried, has been a decline in Asian-American students, and at the to make way for more Black and Latino students. So a lot of people just claim they're lowering standards. The latest two places where this fight has broken out is in Boston. Boston this week just approved a new plan that for its, I think, three top public high schools, like Boston Latin, they're going to replace the test-based entrance with a more holistic criteria. And in Fairfax, Virginia, where the top school in the nation, top public school named by U.S. News and World Report, Thomas Jefferson in Fairfax, they've instituted a program. And whereas last year, under the old system, 73% of those admitted were Asian American, this year that's dropped to 53%. All the other groups, whites, Blacks, and Latinos, increase their enrollment. But some parents are rebelling. And in Virginia, this rebellion took place within the local PTA for Thomas Jefferson. And now the state PTA has intervened to suspend that chapter over this. So, Jason, what's going on in these fights over admissions? I mean, it seems very complicated, the formulas. But in many ways, it's all the same story, isn't it?
You know, I've been writing about this these controversies over testing and efforts to eliminate testing requirements, mostly at the college level, for a few years. You know, it's been the movement has sort of been the anti-SAT and anti-ACT movements have sort of been growing slowly for the past few years. Now we've seen not only a tremendous, you know, drop in requirements of standardized testing to get into college, which is assisted by the pandemic because they had to cancel some of the tests and then kept, continuing that policy of canceling the tests. But now all of a sudden we see it in high school, and it's the same arguments. And, you know, it's basically that if we have an unequal performance on a test, the test must be discriminatory and we should drop the test. And, you know, the problem that goes without saying is that, you're not changing anything by not testing people. You're re-engineering, you think you're re-engineering the sort of demographic composition of the school based on average scores, but you're just really striking at meritocracy. I mean, you're not going to judge kids anymore on what they know. I mean, there's this idea of holistic, and admissions bureaucrats love it. We use holistic admissions. We judge the whole person. And what it really means is it gives them more power to be more subjective and to not need to look at any hard or numerical criteria. And, you know, ultimately, as we know, use that for political ends.
Kim, there's an African-American parent at Thomas Jefferson who has one son in the school, got there under the old system, and he's very set against dropping the standards, that he didn't raise his kids to believe that they couldn't do it on merit. He said he would love to see more Black students in this school. But the answer to that, he says, is improving the pipeline, meaning the lower schools and so forth. Why such a focus on the schools where people are learning and achieving, and so little focus on the urban school systems that are doing a disastrous job for Black and Latino students? I don't understand the outrage. I mean, so many kids, there are very few Black and Latino kids reading and doing math at proficient level in, say, the New York City school system. Yet that's not the scandal. You know, the high-performing schools are the scandal. Why is that?
Well, you just put your finger on it. You and Mr. Jackson. And by the way, for all listeners, if you have not read Bill's magnificent column on this earlier this week, definitely go do it. It was very eye-opening. But what we've seen here, what you and Jason have been describing, is that when you have these schools with these admissions tests and you have more Latinos and African Americans who fail to get in, the instant claim from progressives is that somehow this is white oppression, and that somehow the testing situation or the schools have been stacked against those particular entrants, instead of looking at the obvious point, which you make, and Mr. Jackson, that man, the graduate of the Naval Academy, makes, which is that these are the schools that so many Black and Latino young Americans are subjected to are failing them right and left. They are in urban areas dominated by school unions where you can't get rid of poor teachers, where they're not subjecting kids to a rigorous education. And in fact, where most of the public education establishment, rather than focusing on these defects in their own system, spend most of their time and all of their efforts attempting to stop charter schools from coming up, places that these kids could actually have a chance to do better. And, you know, I think that that's too why the progressives increasingly have this big problem, which is the Asian American storyline, because, you know, they want to suggest, again, that all of this is happening because of a white oppressive majority. At the same time, they can't, because you have Asian American kids who are taking these tests and they're doing really well and they make up significant proportions of these schools. They show that this is more about meritorious achievement than it is anything to do with race. It's now leading to all this sort of litigation that you're mentioning, it potentially with the opportunity in court to dismantle some of this crazy stuff.
Yeah. Jason, how much does this have in common? There are a whole bunch of cases now involving racial preferences, right? Not just at schools, but primarily at schools. There's cases with Joe Biden's Farm Aid, where he the aid gives preferences to African-American farmers, and the same for restaurant aid. There's a couple of judges that have come out against that. There's also, most famously, there is this Harvard case where a group of Asian Americans are saying Harvard admissions discriminates against us because they're admitting less qualified people over us. And they're using subjective ratings, like they consistently give them personality scores. As Kim mentioned, the progressives seem to have such a hard time with Asian Americans because they stand in the way first of the narrative that America is divided into white oppressors or the non-white oppressed. And then when they're faced with that, they either say, well, we're going to abolish the test so we're not embarrassed by the racial gaps, or we're going to declare Asian Americans white or white adjacent or a non-minority. It seems that the progressives just cannot deal with Asian Americans. We've also seen this, you know, kind of rebellion brewing in, deep blue Washington state that rejected an effort to bring back race preferences. It couldn't have been all just Asian Americans voting that down.
You're right. Washington state rejected it. California rejected it, I think, by an even larger margin of more than 10 points. So you really have a situation where the public doesn't like race preferences. You can, you know, I think the judge in your column, Bill, said something. You can call it any beautiful thing you want. You know, it still is what it is. So we're hearing new words like equity and a whole bunch of new vocabulary. But there is a real progressive effort, I think, to break with sort of, to some extent, really break with the tradition even of Democrats for the last few decades, which was to generally shy away from solutions that are explicitly race-based. But now we're seeing that come back. There's no question. And it is hitting up against the federal judges, as you mentioned, with those two Biden programs.
Right. Kim, I'm going to give you the last word here. The case in Fairfax, as well as the case in Boston, are now the subject of lawsuits in these states. But the bigger and more famous lawsuit is the one of Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard over the treatment of Harvard. And the Supreme Court declined to take it up. They didn't reject it. They postponed it. What's the message you hear? I mean, do you think that they can really duck this with all these other cases, again, from Farm Aid to the high schools coming up? Do you think that they really can duck this issue, as they have for really 50 years, you know, giving us more complex formulas and so forth, but never conclusively ruling in a clear and unequivocal way one way or the other?
No, not at all, especially not in an environment like we have today, where the entire discussion is now on quotas and equity. You are having, as you guys were discussing, federal programs that are outright racist at least in the way that they are structured, that they can only flow to certain races and not to others, which is kind of a stunning thing when you think about it. And so they're going to have to. And I think the hesitancy you have seen, they took on a couple of other really big cases for this next term. But they're going to have to also, just because, as you mentioned, their entire history of judicial rulings on this has been extremely muddy, in particular on sort of racial preferences and their use in university admissions. We can blame that on former Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was a swing vote for a long time and always seemed to want to split the difference here and was all over the map. But he's gone now. There is now a sort of 6-3 conservative majority on the court. Most of them have at different times in their careers expressed real concern and alarm with the way these preferences are being used. So there's an opportunity here too for them to really settle a lot of law, and let's hope that they take it up sooner rather than later.
Okay. Thank you, Kim and Jason. That's all the time we have today. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.